Dwight Garner is a book critic for the New York Times, a former senior editor of the New York Times Book Review. He was the founding books editor of Salon.com. His writing has appeared in Harper's Magazine, The Oxford American, The Nation, Slate, Vanity Fair, and elsewhere. And he is, now, this was a while back, he is at work on a biography of James Agee. So you finished that?
No, I put that aside for a bit. I'm working on some other things.
Okay. What are you working on?
Well, I have a new book out called Garner's Quotations, A Modern Miscellany, which is a unique sort of book. It's a book of quotations that sort of reads like a book of poems. And it sort of subverts the genre, I hope, because books of quotations, to my mind, tend to be, most of them skewed to the upbeat and the sort of chicken soup for the soul. And mine is very dark. Mine is about sort of feeling bad about yourself. And it's not just that. It's about wit. It's about food and revenge and lust and sex and literature and poetry. And it's just a different kind of book of quotations.
So it's realistic then.
I hope so.
Good. Well, and you live still in Garrison, New York?
No, that was quite a while ago. I'm living now on Cape Cod in Provincetown, but I am moving to New Orleans soon. It's funny, when you have a job like mine, you know, I've been a book critic for the Times now for 10 or 12 years. You don't really need to be in any one place. And so I've been sort of using this period to move around a bit.
That's great. Yeah, you just file your review, right?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with traveling is, someone like you, I'm sure, as a collector, I'm sure you know what this is like. The only drawback is that I have so many goddamn books that it's, you know, moving around is not as easy as it might seem. I mean, I have some in storage, but, you know, books are heavy, and it's hard to move a lot if you're weighed down with these things.
Storage, that's where most of mine are, and I hate that. It's almost like having a limb cut off, because it's like, okay, I know I got that somewhere, and I want to reference it, but I can't.
Right. Luckily, there are more, you know, it's easier to find quotations and things online now. I mean, I spend a lot of time looking up things in books that I don't have. You go onto Amazon, you do a search inside, and I can often find quotes and references and things that I need that way. But yeah, not having the book in hand is a bummer.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the Bibliophile.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we're going to talk about Read Me, A Century of Classic American Book Advertisements. And right at the very beginning, you have Truman Capote saying, "A boy has to hustle his book."
That's a pretty good Capote imitation.
What was it? A friend of mine said that he had a voice of a baby whale.
It's pretty good.
How did you first get into this project?
You know, I've been at the New York Times now for 22 years. The first decade I spent as an editor at the Book Review, meaning that, you know, books came in and we would assign them to reviewers. And I was one of the people who read the books that came in. I was a fiction preview editor, we called them. And so I would read the books that came in, decide which ones, you know, we should review. There are other people doing this too, but I was one of them. And then find a good reviewer to review it. And I would often end up going back into the archives of the Times to look for, you know, previous ways we covered this writer or that writer. And I would sometimes stumble upon some great advertisement. I would just, by looking through an old print edition, I would find some glorious ad for, you know, the first Toni Morrison's first novel or something by Updike, and I would say, wow, look at that. And I just thought, people should see these, you know. And I started just sort of, when I saw one, I would take a picture of it. I would clip it electronically, because normally I couldn't just take it right out of this bound volume I was looking in. But I started collecting them. Then I showed them to an editor friend of mine, and he said, you know, this is a book. And it turned into one.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. So let's work your way through the introduction. You talk about the fact that you get to see how an author often is introduced to the public before they become a monument of our literary culture.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a moment in everyone's life when Kurt Vonnegut is not yet, quote unquote, Kurt Vonnegut. He's just some guy from Indianapolis who has a first novel and is as worried about it as everyone else is. And it's interesting to see how publishers decided to package writers, how they thought they would be able to market them, you know, and the kind of stunts they would sometimes pull. But often the first ads are quite modest. And, you know, you realize that these books, if it had possibly the wrong critic review it or just got a piece of bad luck how some of these books might have had a harder time making it.
Well, some of the ads capitalize on the fact that there are mixed reviews, so they try to stir up a bit of a controversy, don't they?
Yeah, Mailer was the best at that. Mailer had a couple different books in which he printed all the negative reviews and just sort of stirred the pot. And those are great. I think I kind of miss people doing that. One writer or cartoonist, Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury, still does that in all his books. He loves it when some famous panjandrum, you know, Trump or some other person who would just hate his work, he always prints those on his paperbacks, and they're always the best.
Yes. You say in the introduction that in many of these ads, there is a sense of destiny, but also of vulnerability.
Oh, I think that's true. I mean, I go back to the Toni Morrison ad again. I mean, you look at this person, and she's, you know, she wasn't that young when her first novel was published, The Bluest Eye. I think that came out in 1970, maybe 67. I think it was 70. She was probably in her early 30s. And you just look at her and you think, you know, she did not yet know what was in store for her, nor did readers know what kind of brilliance that she would ultimately be tailing along behind her. You know, a writer writes a first book, and, you know, a lot of writers only have one book in them. We don't know whether, you know, they have this freight that they're going to bring to our lives. Sometimes it's just that one book. In Toni Morrison's case, you feel like you're staring at a kind of destiny there.
Yeah, what's interesting is how you point to the fact that initially, and initially is right like the turn of the century, 1900 and forward, the emphasis is on the book rather than the author.
I think that's true. I think, you know, the culture of celebrity started creeping up on us about mid-century. Also, photography became, the technology grew better. And you notice publishers begin to capitalize on writers who have the good fortune of looking like, you know, the ideal poet or the ideal novelist. Some writers, frankly, are better looking than other writers. And publishers are aware of this. They're not stupid. And, you know, when you have a writer, and when I say better looking, I don't always mean in a classic way. Some writers are just beautiful looking in their kind of their strange ways of looking. You know, A.J. Liebman, yeah. Really ugly guy in some ways, but also beautiful in his unattractiveness, you know. So there are many different kind of faces that are great on a book cover. As you move along, you realize that some ads have the author's photograph in blown up quite large, and other ones don't have it at all. And there's often a reason for that.
Although readers typically wouldn't really care what they look like. They're interested in what they have to say.
Well, you would like that to be true, and so would I, but I know enough people in the publishing industry to know that, you know, when a publisher is taking, you know, a young writer's marketability into account, it does not hurt to be an attractive person. I'm not saying at all that's make or break in this world, but it does come into play.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you think about Salinger and you think about Kerouac, a couple of super good-looking guys.
That's true. It's funny, I know people, my wife is one of them, who refuses to look at dust jacket photographs. She just doesn't want to know. And I kind of see that point. I often don't want to know either. Although I will say, while going through these ads for this book we're talking about, often the photographs are what drew me in the first place. There's something about the ads with photographs that's, first of all, A, they're often photographs of writers we haven't seen before. So that's just initially interesting. To have a new photograph, you know, of Garcia Marquez or someone like that you hadn't seen before is just interesting on its own. And then to see this young writer whom this may be his first professionally taken photograph, at least by someone in terms of being a writer, this may be the first photograph anyone's ever taken of them because they're a writer. You know, they might have other family photographs. And it's just a fragile moment.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I mean, this is quite a debate and it's an ongoing debate about, so how important is the writer's biography?
Yeah, but I, that's the great thing about writers. You don't have to come from anywhere. I mean, or you don't have to graduate from college, even high school. It's just what matters is what's on the page, you know?
Yeah.
I just was writing a bit about Martin Amis. And of course, he is the son of Kingsley Amis, the British writer. And Martin wrote somewhere that, of course, the ideal writer comes from nowhere. He said, alas, you know, what can I do about it? I come from somewhere. Everyone knows my father. I can't help where I come from. And, writing is that way. I think the poet Philip Levine, who was a blue-collar poet, used to write on the back of his book something like, you know, Philip Levine has had a series of shitty, low-paying jobs and now writes books, something like that. And people look for this authenticity in the fact that, you know, at least they did in a certain time in American literature, you know, the author, you know, rode trains across the heartland. And I think those days are largely behind us. But Yeah, it is interesting to know a bit about a writer's background.
Well, isn't it true that the reader may think that the work, even if it is fiction, is more authentic if the author has actually experienced something like it?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, it doesn't have to be true, but experience matters. I think the British critic Clive James wrote somewhere, he always wished that Henry James had gone to sea, you know, and fought, because Henry James, this amazing stylist, what if something had actually happened to him? You know, what would we have then? But I love Henry James without him having gone to sea, but it's interesting to think about.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, these ads are capitalizing on the natural curiosity of the readers of the books, because if you love a book, you're just naturally inclined to want to know about the author. That's the thinking behind these ads, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, to me, it's just, it's literary history that no one's ever really bothered to collect before.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that I think, I mean, you being a collector of a lot of sort of literary things, and I feel a bit that way myself. I saw these and realized that, you know, someone should put these together. These are meaningful as American literary history.
So where precisely did you see them again? You saw them sort of digitally?
When I was an editor at the Times, they had bound volumes of the Book Review going back forever until the Book Review started. I think that was in 1911, but I'm not certain that was the year. And I would see them in there, and sometimes in the electronic archives, when I was searching through the archives on my computer, once in a while they would come up, because some of the Times archives have been digitized but not turned into just print yet. You can see an entire page, and I would see these pages and say, Jesus Christ, look at that.
In your introduction, you have a whole bunch of interesting little nuggets, like, for example, the little story about Richard Savage, the poet who ends up murdering someone, and then his publisher advertises the books that haven't been selling, and they sell overnight. That's beautiful.
You know, notoriety is always a good thing. You know, my wife had a novel coming out. We were deciding, you know, if she, I don't know, what could she do to make the whole world pay attention? You know, leap off a bridge. No, don't kill yourself to sell your book. Although people have tried that. There have been some cases where people have faked suicides to try to get some attention for their books. A guy in New Orleans about 20 years ago did that. I think it was, Evelyn Waugh, who I think one of his novels has a character scheming up ways to land in the newspaper for a reason, nothing to do with his book, just to do something crazy. And notoriety sells.
You also reference the fact that Benjamin Franklin, in his Poor Richard's Almanac, used the first edition in 1732 to falsely announce the impending death of his rival.
Isn't that great? Where have these times gone? You know, where's the fun anymore?
Yeah. Well, I guess now the big notoriety isn't good for publishing. It's you know, around things like plagiarism.
Right. But I'm trying to think what I was going to say about that. You know, I feel like there haven't been any major plagiarism cases for a while. I think the internet and the easy searchability of all text has made writers more fearful than ever about even getting close to plagiarizing anyone.
True. Now, you suggest that the print advertisements for Uncle Tom's Cabin are among the first that seem truly modern. And why is that?
Could you have a picture of it there?
I do, yeah.
I believe the publisher's text struck me as modern. Something about, I think it's at the bottom, the greatest book of the age, the hyperbole in it, and there's something about it's very punchy. A lot of book advertisements pre that period were rather staid, and that book seemed to, that ad sort of leaps off the page a bit.
Although advertising per se has always been about hyperbole and great big promises and claims.
It's true.
That goes back to the beginning of whenever anyone tried to sell anything.
No, absolutely. And yet publishers often thought of themselves as sort of a quote unquote gentleman's occupation. I mean, they were sort of above, you know, vulgar grubbing for eyeballs, you know, and of course they were not, but that was the pretension at any rate.
In that same ad, I'm just looking here underneath, it says already 300,000 volumes have been sold.
Pretty great. You'd still want those kind of numbers.
Well, yeah. And also, I guess it speaks to this idea that, well, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me.
Right, right. 5 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. Is that what it was?
Yeah. Yeah, this gets back to this idea of personality. Here you quote Joseph Addison from the 18th century, and he says, he explained in the London Spectator, I have observed that a reader seldom peruses a book with pleasure till he knows whether the writer of it be a black or fair man, of a mild or choleric disposition, married or a bachelor, with other particulars of like nature that conduce very much to the right understanding of an author.
I'm not sure I fully agree with that sentiment. I think knowing a bit about the writer is just, you know, it sort of whets the appetite just a bit. But ultimately, you should go in the store and read the first two pages of something and take it from there and let the story be told you and submit to the spell that's being cast.
You talk about the earliest book ads of the century. You say they were generally straightforward, leaning on typography more than any other design element.
Often that's all they really had at their disposal. I mean, they're often photographs weren't available. Art is difficult and weird. And often book jackets alone aren't necessarily, they might grab your eye on a bookstore shelf, but perhaps wouldn't grab your eye in print, if reproduced in print. So typography is what they had to work with. And some of them were quite expert at it. You know, you'd like to have sort of letterpress prints of some of those ads.
Yes, really, it's, some of the greatest design work ever has got to do with typography and the way that fonts are used.
Absolutely.
Despite all the other stuff that's available now.
Yeah, I'm a big letterpress fan, and I have some letterpress posters that are just type, and they're great.
And then photographs of writers did not become common in book advertising. And these are obviously all observations you've made by being able to look at the complete world of these ads. That's obviously part of the reason you wrote the book.
Yeah, well, I went through back many, many back issues of the New York Times, of the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Wall Street Journal, some other papers, San Francisco Chronicle, but also the New Yorker, Harper's, you know, magazines that are venerable and have covered books for a long time. Did I say the Atlantic, New Republic, places like that. And so they're culled from all over the place. The New York Times has sort of been central in many ways to American publishing since the Book Review started. It's certainly not alone in this, but in terms of one-stop shopping, it is probably the best place if I had to pick just one place to look for these.
Yeah. So photographs became popular in the 1920s, and once they did begin to play a role, publishers used them to sculpture or mold the writer's public persona. Witness Fitzgerald, his hair parted down the center. He comes off as a jazz age, a smart set city slicker. And on the other hand, Hemingway is a barrel-chested he-man photographed outdoors. So doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way they were, but I guess the publisher and the author worked together to come up with this persona.
Yeah, I mentioned Martin Amis earlier in something he wrote recently. Excuse me. He said that most writers usually only have about one word that people use to describe them, but they remember about them. He said for Christopher Hitchens, that word was contrarian. He said for himself, he thought it was something like, not overrated, but some word implying that his best work was behind him, you know.
Right.
And, you know, in Hemingway, it helped, I think, to have a simple persona for Hemingway to project. Not necessarily a false one, but a useful one for sure. And ditto for Fitzgerald. I mean, Fitzgerald's perhaps didn't serve him as well, or wouldn't have served him as well, when the Depression hit, and it didn't quite, his jazz age persona kind of stuck with him when times got harder. It made him perhaps slightly less relevant than he might have been had he not been so tightly linked to that, to the roaring 20s.
Yeah. I'm just looking at the next paragraph here. You say writers learn to play along to a degree, as the sardonic Sinclair Lewis had his narrator suggest in Babbitt. In other countries, art and literature are left to a lot of shabby bums living in attics and feeding on, on booze and spaghetti. But in America, the successful writer or picture painter is indistinguishable from any other decent businessman.
That's great. Well, you know, I'm looking forward to getting back to New York after COVID, and I'm having more booze and spaghetti. So,
but it is an interesting idea, isn't it? That publishers and authors work together to they started branding themselves.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was that calculated. You know, and I'm not even sure it is today. I mean, I'm sure a bit of that goes on, but I, you know, in Fitzgerald and Hemingway's case, and I'm sure that publishers knew what they were trying to present, and as publishers do now, but who knows? I mean, some of it's calculated, some of it isn't, some of it's just the way people are, you know, right. But I do know that knowing enough people in publishing and having a few books published myself, you know, there are people well paid to think hard about this and paid to think about how to position a book, how to position the writer, how to get this book, this persona in front of the kind of people who are going to respond to this book and this persona. So it's a business as well
yeah.
as an art.
Yeah. And of course, you know, much of this book is, and the success of these ads obviously are just sort of predicated on a certain number of tenets that hold true for successful advertising.
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's too bad. It's too bad, isn't it, that in Mad Men, we couldn't see Don Draper working on the, you know, the James Baldwin account or something. You know, that would have been something.
Yeah. Well, maybe they could do a kind of a literary spinoff and just have literary clients.
I'm there.
I like your talking about Amos. And again, though, that sort of fits with this conversation here. And that is, yeah, like one word describes the author. It just makes it that much easier for the advertiser to work with the author.
Yeah. You know, the advertiser in this case, as you know, is the publisher. Publishers have publicity wings, and those are the people who do this in publicity and marketing. Yeah, but I mean, in general, these departments, for at least for many publishers, are quite small. You're not the size of, you know, it's not Madison Avenue stuff. I mean, publishers are serious about it for sure, but they tend to be, you know, sort of small units, and it's a different kind of advertising.
For sure, and there's absolutely no way they had anywhere near the budget that alcohol or cars, for example, had.
Right, and it's a pity. I mean, these print ads are kind of drying up now. I mean, there are many reasons for that. You know, I mean, you know, as eyeballs are driven to the web, people are searching for new ways to advertise. As I'm sure you know, so many book sections in America have shut down. I mean, the great North Carolinian writer, Reynolds Price, wrote a memoir about 15, 20 years ago. He said that when he started writing in the 50s or 60s, a typical good first novel might get 100 or 115 reviews. He wrote this in the 90s, let's say, and he said, now that book might get 15 reviews. I would say now that book might get 5 reviews. Yeah. The book review outlets have vanished. Many newspapers don't review books anymore, or if they do, just in a very small way. And so along with these reviews, often have fled the book advertising. It doesn't appear either. So it's kind of a dying form.
Well, isn't it interesting that one of the key features of all of these ads is that they rely on quotes from critics and other authors?
Right, the infamous blurb. And I'm sure, as you know, and your listeners know, there's a big difference between a blurb and a quote from an actual review. I mean, the blurb is often the writer's friends. There are things the publisher gathers in advance, and blurbs often tell you more about who the writer knows than how good the book is. Before a book comes out, the publisher will solicit nice bits of praise from the author's friends or people who might be inclined to like that writer's work. And normally you can't really believe those. I mean, I you know, once in a while one might be accurate, but in general, it's safe to assume those are bullshit. Now, once a book is reviewed on the paperback, you'll get actual quotes from reviewers, which are actually taken from book reviews. So it's kind of a different animal.
That really is a problem. I think it's always been a problem, but even more so now. It's like all of these blurbs and such, they're such bullshit that they set up your expectations, and inevitably you're going to be disappointed.
Right, which is why you should never believe a book blurb. I mean, as I said, they're just mostly friends of writers. And for a young writer or an old writer to have all these famous names blurbing them, it's a way of suggesting, I think, to critics also, like, you mess with me, well, you're also messing with this writer, this writer, this writer, this writer, this writer, who think I'm great, so go to hell. You know, it's a way of sort of arming yourself a bit. And but, you know, everyone does it. Blurbs are, you know, it just, they've been around. They're kind of like rats that we can't quite get out of the storeroom, you know, but it's best to take them with a grain of salt.
There's also, interestingly, and I'm not sure I saw too much of it, but reference to film, films that have been made out of, from books. And here's the quote, photographs were put to wackier purposes in the 20s too. In 1927, the publisher Doubleday, Page and Company sought to sell an edition of Joseph Conrad's complete works with a wild, busy, full-page ad under the titillating headline, Jungle Love, What Happened When a White Man and a Native Girl Met Far From Civilization. Doubleday used a photograph from a B-grade movie of one of Conrad's novels depicting a bearded man and a woman who'd wilted under his masculine gaze.
Oh, Jesus. You wonder what Conrad thought. I'm sure he wasn't pleased, although perhaps if it moved some units, maybe he was pleased. Who can say?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It may have moved a bunch of the books. And so, I suppose he may have basically said, I don't care how you do it, just sell my books. I wonder.
I can still remember when I was a wee lad, you know, and you go into the, you know, back, and you still had those spinning paperback racks in supermarkets and in drugstores. And often you'd be spinning that rack around. There'd be some sort of, you know, hot chick on the cover of some paperback and some stud there on a motorcycle next to her. And you know, you're 12, you're thinking, all right, I'll give that a shot. And it turns out to be Elmore Leonard or something. Sometimes these writers who were excellent were marketed in this mass market kind of way. And I miss those days. The new Stephen King novel has a cover like that on it. It's a lot of fun, the cover. I haven't read the book yet.
Well, I know that in France, it was quite a scandal because they started advertising with these lurid covers, some of the great French classic novels. And it sold them. but the upper class, the elite, the literati, were quite scandalized by it.
Yeah, I think Philip Roth had a pulpy cover or two in some period of his career, I think in the 90s. Not super pulp, but pulpy for him. And, I'm in favor of a bit of pulp once in a while. I have no problem with that. But, you know, but that Conrad is just mind-blowing. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Of course, he's the man who said... I don't read my reviews. I just measure them.
Well, he also, I mean, Kurtz got up to all sorts of disgusting stuff too.
Yeah.
Or he leaves most of it to the imagination, but I like the fact that you identify someone who I'd never heard of before. The ads have for, this is Knopf books you're talking about, the distinctive Knopf books, the ads have for many decades largely been created under the supervision of one woman, Nina Born.
Yeah, Nina Born is a legend in the advertising industry. I believe she worked at Simon & Schuster for a while too. She was involved in some major campaigns that are seen in the book world as sort of standard of the art. One of these campaigns was for Joseph Heller's Catch-22. He had spectacular ads for that book, and Nina Born was behind them. And Nina died when I did this book. She was still alive. She was, I believe, in her late 80s or early 90s, and she was still going to the office at Alfred A. Knopf. She died about 5 or 6 years ago, but an absolute legend in the industry. I'm surprised. Well, I mean, I was going to say I'm surprised no one's written an obituary of her. Maybe the life isn't quite large enough for an obituary, but I would certainly read 20,000 words or 10,000 words on Nina Born and her career. I would enjoy reading that.
I guess there's not a biography.
I don't think so. it's funny, for a while, everyone was hot on these short, Amazon was doing this series of books that were, you know, short novella size books. And you don't hear much about these anymore, but a biography of Nina Bourne would be a perfect 30,000 word, 25,000 word biography.
Yeah, I'll just read this out here. She gave Knopf ads their look. You write, clean, uncluttered, heavily bordered, black and white. Just as important, she was and is, she was alive back then, as you say, a gifted and concise writer, able to uncork a book's elusive essence with a few perfectly chosen words.
That's a hard part of publishing, actually. You know, a lot of art goes into the copy on an advertisement, also the copy that goes on to a dust jacket. And it's funny, my daughter, who's still in college, is preparing to go into publishing, and she sort of has a job. She's without getting too much into my daughter, she's been asked to write some copy for a dust jacket, and she's realizing now how hard it is, and you really to boil a book down. I mean, it's something I guess I do every day. It's sort of my job as a critic to do this, but to boil the book down, not just to its subject matter, but its themes and about why it's sort of worth paying attention to. It's a fine art. It really is. And it's rarely done that well. And Nina Bourne did it very well.
Well, and why you should read it, obviously.
Yeah. But it's hard to, no one wants to read a book really. And someone said this about the reviews on, let's say, Yelp. Let's say a restaurant can get a bad review on Yelp, but if it's written really poorly and it's spelled poorly, and it may not matter that much. What matters is a sort of like a really well-reviewed, a good review by someone who seems like they know what they're talking about, and it's there are no misspellings in it, and the grammar is good, and you sort of believe this person because they seem like they have the head on their shoulders. And there's something similar in advertising copy for a book. I mean, if it's well expressed, you think, well, perhaps this book might be just as well expressed.
And also, I think what you're looking for is credibility, a credible voice. And obviously that's why they pick out critics and other writers, a credible voice who can make a good recommendation to you so that you won't waste your time on the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nina was the best. I should find out who's doing it now and who's doing great work now. I don't really know in the publishing world who is revered in terms of this kind of work.
I need to interview that person if I can find him. It's part of my project. Yeah, you say that she had a classy but alert vibe.
Yeah, well, you know, she was with Alfred A. Knopf, which for generations was sort of the gold standard in American publishing. I mean, they were just, they had the best writers for the most part. They didn't have a lot of crap on their list. I mean, they had just really solid, you know, they published a lot of the great writers of the past century, and they had a sense of style about them. Their books were very attractively made, well made. Yep. Their ads were nice. They sort of set the standard in many ways. And their ads, you know, reflected that. And, you know, which was part of Nina Bourne's genius, was to have ads that felt sophisticated and yet not so much that they felt over the heads of readers. You know, they could appeal to an average reader.
Yeah, exactly. They weren't snobbish or condescending.
Yeah.
In the 30s, you say it was the first decade that America's critics were famous enough to be frequently quoted. And so Clifton Fadiman, Alexander Wolcott, Dorothy Parker.
Yeah, Alfred Kazin. Yeah, I mean, you could quibble with that, I think, a bit. There were some in the 20s and some in the 10s. You know, there's always been some, but there was a sort of a group that emerged in the 30s, you know, and you began to get this ferment in New York City and in Washington, a group of critics who kind of bounce things back and forth. You would wait to see what one or the other had to say about a book, and a sense of a real conversation going on about books. And the hubbub really helped books. And that's one thing that's, I brought this up before, and it's a hobby horse of mine, but I, along with the disappearing of book ads, has been the disappearing, as I said, of book reviews. And it's just too bad, because you had a sense in the 30s and in other periods of this conversation among critics. Now, a critic like myself will review a book, and I'm sort of hitting a ball across the net, and there's no one there to return it. It often seems like it's you know, and it gives the Times Review too much power, which frankly the Times shouldn't have. And I No one should have it, is my point. I mean, I respect the Times as book critics and what they're trying to do, but I kind of wish some days that I lived in London right now, where there are seven or eight daily newspapers, and on the day a book comes out, there might be five reviews of a single book. And there's this sense of, let's go see what these people had to say. And now in the book world, it's just, it's like little fireflies winking just one every 3 days or something. In the sense of, there's no, just the tumult somehow is not what it used to be.
The other person that you identify, and again, I love that you've done this, you'd say that in the 50s, that publishers started to farm out some of their creative to ad agencies. And the one that stands out, well, in particular, is Franklin Speer. Can you talk a bit about him?
You know, Speer was an interesting guy. It's funny, he was around until just recently, but he was sort of a, do I print any of his ads? Do I print any of his work?
I don't think you identify them as such. You probably do, though.
Yeah, he had a good way, and publishers sought him out. And
what do you mean, good way?
Well, he like Nina Bourne, he had a way of summing up a book and finding a striking visual style to present it. You know, I mean, a lot of writers, I mean, not a lot, but a fair number of writers began as ad men. You know, Don DeLillo worked in advertising. Salman Rushdie worked in advertising. Yeah. James Dickey worked in advertising. And, you know, bright, bright people work in the ad world. Often their products, you wouldn't think so to look at them, but a lot of verbal dexterity in many ads, and his were particularly so.
You say that the heyday for advertising was, it truly commenced in the 1950s.
Yeah, the late 50s, early 60s. You know, I mean, the world just kind of opened up, didn't it? I mean, the world began to transition into color, and suddenly there was Elvis, and suddenly there was Jack Kerouac, you know, we sort of entered, you know, it's like sometimes seems like the 40s sort of hung on until about 1957 or 58, and, right. and the 60s began creeping in around then, and got to be a lot more juice in the culture and juice in the literature, and a lot of conventions were broken. And, you know, it had to do with, there were a lot of aspects to this. I mean, the famous rulings about Ulysses and, yeah. You know, a lot of censorship issues coming to a boil, and a sense of Henry Miller finally being issued, and a sense of just an opening up of things. And language was no longer, books didn't have to be so bolderized in order to be published. You know, Norman Mailer with his famous, you know, fug you and Armies of the Night. I mean, the whole culture was cracking open, and the advertising, you know, sort of reflected that.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, to align, I mean, Ulysses was first published in the States in 1934, but that ruling,
it wasn't in the 1800s.
Lady Chatterley's Lover ruling was 1960-61.
Yep. So right around this time, though, there's a lot of ferment, you know, with
for sure.
Allen Ginsberg reading Howl for the first time. It's just, you know, a sense of barriers falling in a very healthy way.
Yeah, and that spilled over into the advertising and promoting of books, obviously.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, here it is. In the 1960s and 70s, it seemed to be like the glory days of American book advertising. The books and the ads for them were terrific. Fresh, pushy, serious, and wry, often all at the same time. There was a new sense of electricity in the culture and in the book world.
It's funny. Why is it that so many of us, and I may glorify the 60s and 70s in terms of its culture? I mean, we tend to think with the 80s, it was the Reagan era, and things sort of lost their bloom somehow. And the 60s and 70s somehow had this, didn't they? Had this sense that everything sort of felt new. There's so many new currents rushing into the culture that now have, you know, these currents are still here, and we still have great writers, but there's a sense of a really identifiably new thing happening, a new generation. And I think it was reflected in the writers who came of age then. And, you know, a lot of these writers now are, you know, we're starting to lose them. I mean, a lot of these writers now are at the very end, tail end of their careers, if they're still around. Your Roths and your Updikes and your Toni Morrisons and writers like that, who all contributed to this wave. And things just felt like you felt anything could happen. You felt that publishers were kind of leading the culture instead of following the culture.
That's beautifully put. Yeah, I like that. That's, in fact, just up here in Canada, a same sort of thing. Like, I collect books that reflect the design of the period. And so The Evolution of Canadian Book Design, and it really bursts forth beginning, you know, late 50s and then early 60s. It's just, you know, it's fabulous, super colorful, and
so many currents wrapping together at that time, you know, just a hundred different things. You know, you also had this sort of baby boom generation coming around with the sort of new things to say. You know, you look at the writers of that period, I mean, we're hard pressed now, I think, to find, and I'm a working book critic. There are many, many writers today whom I revere and I think are quite near geniuses, but there was somehow a hard core of these writers, and it was an identifiable core. Culture now has become more bifurcated. There's no longer a sort of cultural consensus the way there used to be about what the great works, at least in terms of now, are. It's sort of like in music, you know, there was a time when we all heard the same pop songs and we were sort of all listening to them. We all knew. Now there's, you know, dozens of genres. Everyone's got their sort of own thing. And there's something similar happening with books, I think, and with literary reputations. You know, critics don't have the dominion they once did, and that's probably a good thing. And there's no longer this, I would just say, this cultural consensus around who we should be paying all the attention to.
That's interesting. So you're saying that critical standards contributed to this burst of creativity?
Well, there was a time when writers were more, they were stars more so than today. You would have, right, you would have an Ike or a Roth, and not just the men, a Didion, a Morrison on the cover of Time magazine. And their books would come out, and frankly, Time magazine and Newsweek still really mattered then. A review in Time magazine was a big freaking deal, as was a review in Newsweek. And you would have these books come out, and they were cultural events. These books landed, and you know, you could hear the detonation of them 400 miles away. And it's a rare book now. What happens with, and in part, it's a critical consensus thing. There was a sense then, perhaps things were forced more into their buckets. But there was a sense that we were all looking at the same thing and reading the same thing. And that may not have ever entirely been true, but it felt that way. It felt like, let's all pay attention now to this big novel, Catch 22, that's come down the pike, and it had its moment in the sun. And it's become, books like that are harder to come by. It's harder to make that much room in the conversation anymore for a major novel.
The fact that there's competition from fantastic television series has taken the population away from reading books.
Yeah, I think to a certain degree that's happened, although book sales have been rising in America during COVID. TV has certainly taken some of the thunder out of reading. I remember when I was young, part of the reason that I read, and I'm writing about this in a new project I'm working on, part of the reason you read was just to learn how people lived. You know, it was observational greed. Maybe you lived like me in a family. You know, we weren't poor, but culturally there wasn't a lot of culture in my house. And I wanted to know, like, I would read a Mary McCarthy novel or a Roth novel. Wait, that's what they eat, and that's how they have sex, and they're going here and doing. I just wanted to gobble up everything that I wanted to know how other people live their lives. And now that kind of the bringing the news, the fresh cultural news, that doesn't happen as much in novels anymore. It you know, it happens in television, it happens on Twitter. I mean, yeah, you don't look to a novel now to tell you really. There's a line from somebody about learning about, even just something about like certain kind of contraception that a Mary McCarthy character used in one of her short stories. And some woman was just astonished to find this there. It was sort of useful information. Fiction no longer brings that kind of information in the way it once did. Or it's not as important, it still brings it, but.
Yeah. So if you want to be hip and up with what all the cool people are doing, you watch the TV series, you don't read the books.
Well, if you want to be able to talk at a dinner party, I guess you do, because, you know, God knows, I haven't been to a dinner party now for a year, but what I seem to remember about dinner parties back in the olden days was that at some point someone said, what you watching on Netflix? And then you'd have a conversation for 30 minutes about whatever we're all watching on Netflix, which, you know, frankly got to be a bit of a bore, what we're all watching on television, but it was a sort of thing, it's like sport.
Especially if you haven't watched it.
Yeah, well, I'm way behind, so I...
Yeah, me too.
But that's the thing about, I mean, you know, TV and movies, they're communal experiences. Books generally aren't. It's somewhat rare to be in a room with people who've read a lot of the same books you have. I mean, a lot of people who are well-read have read many things in terms of, you know, great books, but in terms of recent novels and keeping up with things, it's rare to have a conversation like that. You can't just turn the dinner party over to the new, you know, X novel. It doesn't work that way.
So that's the main difference between the periods then. In the 60s, everyone had read the books. Now everyone's watched the TV shows. and they haven't read, and they haven't read the books.
Well, that's a slight simplification, but essentially that there's a, you got a point.
Okay. This, I think, is really interesting. You say that, now we're talking about Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and you, and here it is. Carson's book came under relentless attack from the chemical industry, and her publisher undertook a campaign to forcefully rebut her corporate detractors. That's good. That's idealism. That's the way you want it to be. My concern or sense is that maybe we've sold out now. I don't know. What do you think? Is that too strong?
Well, first of all, it was very canny marketing. I mean, I'm sure that that sold a lot of copies for Rachel Carson. You still see things like this. I mean, publishers still relish controversy. And, you know, the thing is, corporations are too canny now to come out and dispute a new book. But let's say The New Yorker is Elizabeth Colbert, who writes now about the environment and global warming. Shell Oil is too canny to come out and attack her. It's not going to happen anymore.
You don't have to be canny. It's suicide.
Right. Well, exactly. But they would find other ways to push back at things. But no one is going to. But publishers still relish things like that. I mean, a good attack can still really give you a chance to market a book all over again and reframe it.
Yeah, my sense that this was more serious than that, though, you know, and that the publisher really did stand up for the author in a way that
No, you're right. Corporate America was held, and I think it's somewhat higher regard back then. And I think there was a sense that they could really damage this book, and they were sort of scientifically trying to prove things wrong with it. Rachel fought back forcefully, Carson did, and she had the facts on her side.
Yeah. Okay, let's get into, just as we wind this along here, let's just get into some of the ads themselves, okay?
Okay.
So you start in the aughts, 1900 to 1910, and this is neat. This is the ad for
Rudyard Kipling's novel Kim, which your readers can't see, but it's a long, thin strip of an ad with the word Kim repeated many times as if it were like a poem trailing down the page, but the bright bursts of type. And it's an effective ad, I think.
Very much so. As you say, it pounds the title into your head. The other thing is that, and this is, I see this throughout all of the selection of ads, repetition is so prevalent.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's also just attractive. I mean, it's a good visual look.
Here's the same thing with Rebecca.
Mm-hmm.
It's just repeating Rebecca, Rebecca, Rebecca in bold type all the way down the ad, the side of the ad. These early ads, here's one for The Klansman by Thomas Dixon. It looks very much like an article would look like.
Yeah, I mean, you can't believe, you know, this book is the history of the Ku Klux Klan. Is that what that book is? And I can't remember now, frankly, if that book is an expose or whether it is sort of, whether it's sort
yes,
of.
Yes, it is. You know? It is, yeah.
Okay.
And what it says here, it cannot be laid down until read through.
Well, that's always nice to hear.
Yeah. Here's one, again, it's 1908. I think it's very advanced for 1908.
It is. The Red Skull, a huge skull in black with the words imprinted on its forehead, the Red Skull. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, creepy.
Another really common feature, and this is an O. Henry book here. It's a thick border. That seems to be really hot.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have much to work with in terms of typography, you need something bold to pop out at you.
Yeah. Of course, there's, and again, this is 1908, That Man from Wall Street, a wonderful story of sex magnetism vividly told.
Well, who doesn't want all of that?
That bang on. But they're using sex early on. They're also starting to use graphics, and there's a sort of a cartoon image of that.
Yeah, the drawings. My Enemy the Motor is that book, which is funny.
Here's another example of a sort of embroidered border.
Yep.
The idea is to have it stand out from the rest of the copy, obviously. Here is another one where quotes the opinion of a clergyman who knows the real conditions in the stockyards as represented in the jungle by Upton Sinclair. So they're actually printing a letter from a clergyman. So again, trying to get credibility.
No, and you know, it's an interesting ad for a major, major book, a groundbreaking book. And it's kind of a subtle ad in its way. I mean, it's all just text, isn't it? It's a long letter.
Yeah, but interesting again that it's like, if the minister says it's good to read, I better read it. This is the teens. You say that these ads become looser, louder, and more modern. They also become nearly omnipresent. So there's this complaint about clutter already back then.
Interesting.
So there's more line drawings. This one I thought was quite interesting for Sons and Lovers.
Sons and Lovers. Yeah, small ad for G.H. Lawrence. Why don't you read the copy on that? It's a small square ad.
Yeah. It is, I do not ask you to buy it, but I do tell you that Sons and Lovers by D.H. Lawrence is one of the great novels of the age. And that quote is from one of my favorite publishers, tragic life he had, Mitchell Kennerly. I guess he published this, obviously.
Was his house called Kennerly? What was it called?
It was Mitchell Kennerly.
Okay.
So it's the publisher out front, which is kind of unusual.
I like it.
Yeah, he actually had his own bookstore for quite a few years, and then he ran the Anderson Gallery, the auction house, and then he killed himself. But he produced some beautiful, beautiful books and worked for John Lane, the publisher. He came over from England and ran their offices in New York.
Hmm.
In case you wanted to know.
Yeah, I don't think I have any of his books. I'd like to see one.
No, he just paid attention to detail, and they were it's a bit like Knopf, and Knopf may have even worked for him prior to setting up his own publishing house. Here's another an interesting ad where this drawing of this, it looks like some kind of devilish imp, is going out above the box itself.
Not Fanny Kemble. Who was the author? I can't remember. The bestseller back in the period.
I don't know. It just says more E.K. Means. It's a bit confusing, actually. It's Putnam's ad. Speaking of Knopf, they go with very early on, of course, their Borzoi dog. It's a lovely logo.
Mm-hmm. It's been a great logo for them.
And I believe it was designed by Dwiggins, William Dwiggins, who is associated with Knopf. He produced some beautiful, beautiful books for them. What a lot of these ads do is broadcast the popularity of the book, saying, you know, this book has already been read. It's already a bestseller. It's already popular.
Well, that's still important to do. I mean, you know, once a book becomes the way to have a bestseller now is just to go on the list at all, because all things kick into gear for you once your book makes the list. Success begets success in publishing.
Yeah, of course, word of mouth is the big thing. So I guess they're sort of putting words in the mouths of all these people, aren't they? This is a bit odd. I just want to make a quick remark about it. I've just on the show, on this bibliophile, I'm doing a book club. I've just kind of launched it. About a month ago, we discussed The Great Gatsby with someone. And this is really interesting because one of the glaring, obvious fact, at least to me and to my friend who I discussed this with, is that Nick Carraway is gay. So here, interestingly, is the text used in the ad. He has found in his new novel a dazzling field for his powers as a satirist. It is the strange, incredible American present, the queer, glamorous world of today in which the most fantastic ups and downs of fortunes can occur. I just thought, of course, this is before queer is used in the way it is today, but what an interesting connection, not even intended.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't recall that one, but is it a good looking ad?
Yeah, it's pretty clean.
Yeah, text heavy. There's his face.
Yeah, there's his drawing of him. Yeah. So lots of images of the authors, lots of repetition, the 30s. Here's a big ad with Truman Capote in the 40s.
Famous photograph of him on a sort of lying on a sofa, chaise lounge, staring with, he looks about 17, doesn't he? Staring, impishly is not quite the word, very boldly into the camera. It's a famous photograph at the time, an unusual author's photograph.
Well, his hand is down on his crotch too, which is, I think what you start to see is, you mentioned author photographs. There's lots of big claims, of course, in these ads. And the ads are often written as if by an editor who's coming up with a blaring headline.
Right. I see the ad there for John Barth's novel, Giles Goatboy. I mean, it's interesting for me to see a book like that because John Barth, he's one of those guys, right next to an ad for Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, Barth is one of those guys who's looked like he's 60 years old since he was 25, and he's still around. I mean, he's 90 now, I believe. He looks exactly the same. But that was a big modernist novel. That book was important for a lot of people. It's not really my speed. It's not a favorite book of mine, but it's interesting to see how that book was marketed.
He wrote The Sotweed Factor, right?
Yep.
I love that book. It's so funny and dense and good writing, I think. And here's that Vonnegut ad that you were mentioning. It's kind of a piercy stare that he has and a close-up. It's a close-up of him.
Yeah, what does it say? An extraordinary success, a book we need to read and to reread. Kurt Vonnegut Jr., Slaughterhouse-Five.
And a lot of use of, again, sort of typical advertising strategies. This here is, there's sort of reverse type.
Hmm.
Okay, so maybe we could just wind down with some of your thoughts about today versus the heyday of book advertising. We touched on it a bit, but do you think there's any, there's any room for this kind of brilliance today or not?
Well, these aren't important anymore. I mean, not in the same way that they were. I mean, publishers made ads to run in newspapers, in magazines, and you've got different ads in Time and Life and in different newspapers. Now that sort of scene has gone away. And publishers, it now behooves them more to, they want to get their writers onto podcast. They want to get their writers onto NPR. They want to get to learn how Amazon, how to get the most eyeballs on Amazon and eyeballs during Google searches. And it's a different world, in terms of advertising today. It's one I don't pretend to fully understand. I had a book come out recently, and there were meetings with marketers. I had a lot of talk about optimizing Amazon searches and Google results and things that, nothing to do. My book got maybe one small ad that ran electronically. It wasn't a major book, by the way. But, book ads are just, it's a dwindling form. And it's too bad because they were a lovely form that, it's rare to see ads for culture that are sort of this well done, and this they offer a different side of the literary world.
Well, and they're also intelligent, often they are, despite the superlatives. They've didn't change that much over the decades, really, in their intent, obviously. But you see similarities. In fact, that's how you end the book. You take it back to Kim.
I mean, one of the things this book is about, and I don't think I say this, it's sort of the bloody crossroads where art and marketing meet. And, a lot of writers, I think, would prefer not to have ads for their books. I mean, there's something vulgar about the way some of these writers were marketed. And it's just interesting how you take a manuscript, I mean, words, how you take this novel and try to, give it form and shape to present it to the public in a way that to make this an appealing thing for them to buy. And it's interesting to think about.
Well, isn't it just, basically what the publisher wants to do is to replicate the event of a friend of yours coming up to you and pushing this book into your hand and saying, you've got to read this.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And the best ads do that. There's something about them that makes you look twice. And I tried to pick out ones for this book that made you look twice. And some of the better examples of the form. And I'm sort of sentimental about them. I wish we had more of them today.
Well, Dwight, thanks very much for taking the time to go back in time to this book and to these ads. It was a wonderful experience to read it. And I guess this is still out on the market, this book, I assume?
I think it's out of print, but copies can be had, yes. I don't think it's still in print, but I don't believe so. But yeah, there's still copies available. And thank you for your interest in it. I mean, it's something I haven't talked about for a while. And you certainly seem to know a lot about this field. And it was great to talk to you.
Likewise, Dwight. So the book again is Read Me, A Century of Classic American Book Adventures. And it was published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. Thanks very much again.
Thanks, Nigel. Take care.
Yes, you too.